Hi, we are here with Mike T. Nelson from ExtremeHumanPerformance.com. My name is Craig Keaton. I am the founder and the owner of The Movement in Dallas, and you can check us out at themovementdallas.com. And we are here with Mike today to pick his brain, his incredibly large brain, about metabolic flexibility, and excited to kind of jump into the decades of research and education that Mike has, and really explore this topic that he's kind of been bringing out to all of us athletes and to all of us who are seeking fat loss and lean muscle gains, etc. Excited to kind of hear more about his ideas and how he's implementing that, and just kind of go from there. So, Mike, if you can give us a little introduction, that would be great.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for that, Craig. I really appreciate it. I was on one of their calls here with Mike a while back. So you may have heard me yammering then, but if you missed that part, the only reason I give more of a little bit detailed background is not so much that I like to hear myself talk that much, but I just think it's always beneficial when I go to see speakers. I always like to know more of their background so I can get an idea of how they view things, and knowing how they view things, I think it's beneficial to see sort of the pluses and also the limitations of, their background too. So it just helps the end user figure out how they got there. So I did a Bachelor of Arts in Natural Science, minor in chemistry from St. Scholastica in Duluth, Minnesota, which seems like eons ago. I started in 1992, then decided I was going to go to school for engineering. So I did 2 years of postgraduate work in mechanical engineering, actually up at Michigan Tech in the UP of Michigan, that piece of land above Wisconsin that's not really Canada that people forget about. And then I decided, well, I'll just, while I'm here, I'll finish and do a master's. So I ended up doing a master's in mechanical engineering from there. My coursework was primarily in biomechanics, so I did more of the called solid mechanics. It was more of the advanced study of how a craft breaks. And then my research area is actually more in biomedical engineering, looking at heating of different types of tissue by microwave, which was sponsored by the Air Force, which is very interesting. And so after I did that, I was about 7.5 years full-time. I swore up and down I was never going back to school. I was completely burnt out, never wanted to look at a book, anything else again. I lasted about a year and a half and started taking classes, part-time.
Yeah.
And to the company I was working for at the time, they're like, oh, well, if you want to take a few classes, we'll help pay for it. And I'm like, oh, cool. So I started taking more physiology classes and eventually enrolled in the PhD program in biomedical engineering at the University of Minnesota. Got almost all the way through that, only had 2 classes left. Hadn't done any research yet, though. Realized I spent all my free time studying exercise physiology, went to exercise physiology conferences for vacation, annoyed the crap out of people there, and decided, well, I might as well change. So started all over again with classwork in the kinesiology department, and right now I'm just finishing up my dissertation, and I was in the exercise science department. So for my dissertation topics, I'm looking at heart rate variability, and my main overarching goal is looking at metabolic flexibility. So I did a human subjects trial using energy drinks, which actually I'm just in the process of writing that up today as we speak. And yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. I own Extreme Human Performance, train people here in White Bear Lake and all sorts of fun stuff. So a little bit long intro, but the takeaways from that is that I did a background in engineering, which is a little bit different for most people in physiology. Not that it's, better or worse or any different. So I tend to look at things, I guess, a little bit different, because it's physiology is very complex, and I often joke that it's associated with sort of every bad engineering word. It's, nonlinear, anisotropic, all this sort of stuff that if you were to take math or physics to try and describe, it's really difficult. But that doesn't necessarily mean that what you have to do at the end of the day is necessarily difficult. So I think that, ironically, it should be rather simple. So My goal is hopefully to try and explain stuff in sort of simple tests that people can understand. So.
Absolutely. No. Thank you. I think that's great. One of the other things I'd love for you to share with us too is the fact that you know, for any of us out there that have spent time in the collegiate realm, my background's in biochemistry and exercise physiology, so I've had semesters and semesters and semesters with a lot of people that you know, really don't kind of practice what they preach. They're not out there living it. And I find it interesting that they're trying to describe this understanding of physiology without ever actually kind of endeavoring into it themselves. So I'd love to, you know, hear a little bit more about your athletic background as well, because if people don't know out there that you're more than just a walking Wikipedia, but you know, a power lifter, competitor, a sand volleyball player, you know, all kinds of cool stuff. So if you can tell us a little bit more about that, that'd be great.
Yeah, the quick background on that is that I was the most unathletic kid known to man. I think when I graduated high school, I was the same height I am now, so 6'3", weighed like a whole 156 pounds. And so I went to college, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to start training. So, you know, like all guys, you know, I go to the gym, just do bench press and arm curls, and I don't know what the heck I'm doing, you know. And I could never understand necessarily why I was just, you know, horrible at sports. I figured I was just, you know, one of those people that just got the short end of the stick, and kind of the way it was. And so fast forward through a whole bunch of injuries, I've done all sorts of fun stuff to myself. I also like doing kiteboarding, snowboarding, water skiing, all that kind of stuff. So I managed to, in the meantime, pull both hip flexors, strain hamstring, blow out my right ankle, strain wrist, ripped out right shoulder completely, separated left shoulder. So you had all this on top of what I found out later is that I actually had some visual issues. I actually am what's called stereo blind, meaning that I can see normal, and acuity-wise, I can see things. So if you give me an eye chart, I can tell you what letters are on it, but my eyes actually don't work together. So in essence, it's a little bit even worse than trying to walk around with one eye closed. So we've got two eyes that are designed to see in three dimensions, and so I'm currently working through some of that stuff. So fast forward through a few years, I did a bunch of work through Z-Health, I've done RKC, I've done CSCS through the MSCA. And over the time, I've actually realized that, you know, I think it might have been Dr. Cobb from Z-Health that said this once, that if you're unathletic, that's actually not normal. And it'll be better athletes and worse athletes, but if you're really unathletic, there's something else going on. And in my case, it was a combination of, you know, I had a surgery when I was 4.5, so I've had my sternum, you know, cracked open and stuff. Combination of all the injuries and plus some of the visual issues. So now, ironically, it's, compared to other people my age, I actually do pretty good. One of the highest compliments I ever had is I was working with a friend I've known for about 4 years, and we're trying to have her do some athletic stuff, and she's like, oh, well, I've just never been an athletic jock like you. I kind of laughed, and I went, really? She's like, oh, you're very athletic. And I'm like, wow. You know, I mean, compared to what I was, I guess I am. So, and then my whole thing is that it's just, as long as each person's, you know, getting better, I think that's all that really matters. You know, I'm not under any delusions I'm going to win any powerlifting events anytime soon or even place very high. So as long as I do better than what I did before, then I'm, you know, happy with that. I did a grip competition here a couple of weeks ago. Never done any of the events in it before other than one of them. So I figured, well, I don't know. The only way to get better is to try, right? So... yeah,
absolutely. No, and I love that, and I love the fact that, you know, I feel like you're encouraging a lot of these guys out here that, you know, they get on different websites and they're reading all the top guys in the industry, and these guys are throwing up huge numbers, and the competition is not with them, it's with yourself. And so,
yeah,
you know, I love the fact that, you know, you're there to encourage all of us to go, hey, I don't care if you squat 400 or 1,000, we just want to see you yourself get better. So that's very cool.
Oh yeah, because you're either getting better or worse. And the reality is, if you don't do anything, just the whole aging process means you're getting worse. So
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, I'll tell you what, that I think kind of is a good little prelude into the topic of metabolic flexibility. Is one of the things that Mike, you'll talk about for enhancing our metabolic flexibility is exercise and making sure we're using our body. For everybody out there that has never heard of this concept of metabolic flexibility, I'd love for just to get just a general overview of what we're talking about today.
Yeah. It seems like every time I explain it, I probably explain it a little bit different. But in essence, I think, and especially in physiology, people forget that the body is designed to adapt. You know, our friend Frankie said that adaptation doesn't really have an off switch. So we can't really stop adaptation, but I think the faster we can adapt, that's probably better. So you can think of, you know, metabolic flexibility as, you know, able to adapt to different things metabolically in terms of how you can use and process food, which the primarily energy sources for that are fats and carbohydrates. The example I use is if you have someone who's, say, a diabetic, we know that it's been shown through literature time and time again that diabetics are a group of people who have a very hard time processing carbohydrates as a fuel source. And that causes all sorts of other issues, health issues, that kind of thing. So they are very metabolically inflexible to carbohydrates. And unfortunately, there's other groups of people, it's a little more rare, have a hard time with dietary fat. So they're very metabolically inflexible to dietary fat. So if we go to the other end of the spectrum, we look at, you know, someone who's very healthy, you know, works out, and we look at their ability to use carbohydrates as a fuel source, and they can use them efficiently, then they're very metabolically flexible. And ideally, they should be able to use fats also. So in a perfect world, you would want to use fats at the right time during exercise, and then carbohydrates at the right time during exercise. So more lower intensity work in general is going to be more burning the fats for energy. And then as you shift into higher intensity exercise, go do some sprints or whatever, you want to be able to then use carbohydrates because it allows you to get a greater performance increase. And believe it or not, there actually are people that really can't switch very well between one or the other. Which seems kind of wacky. I never really thought that it could get sort of that pushed that far out of line, but it does happen. So you basically want to be able to use anything, really, for fuel without many side effects. Now, if you take that to a sort of logical conclusion, you can come up with all sorts of things. I just think the whole premise is that if you have someone who's a new client, they come in and I go, hey, you're going to have to, you've been sitting on the couch a little bit too long. I can still see you got, you know, cheese noodle dust on your fingers there. You're going to have to eat, you know, broccoli and chicken the rest of your life. And they go, and they run screaming out the door and you never see them again. Now, the reality is they probably have to make some dietary changes and some exercise changes, but their whole goal long term, once they get to their goal or even on the way, it's not to see how, you know, hardcore you can be. It's based on results. Now, some people may need to be 60% compliant, maybe 90% compliant, but the whole thing is to see that how much can you really sort of get away with. I think everybody secretly wants to be, you know, the guy or gal that can kind of eat whatever they want, and they don't really have to worry about much of anything, and they, you know, still look good and they perform well. And from what we know of physiology, that should be pretty possible. That will vary a little bit for every person, obviously, but the goal is to see how much can you actually get away with, not, you know, how hardcore and strict about everything you have to be.
Sure. No, that's very, I think that's one of the, you know, kind of one of the bright points of this, you know, this program or this concept that, you know, that you're teaching is the fact that I have personally worked with a lot of people in in the performance realm, so a lot of athletes from Olympic to professional, collegiate and high school, and to all different ranks. And I've also worked with fitness competitors and figure athletes, and even my wife comes from the school of fitness competition and figure athletics. But I say that because one of the interesting things I often find is that they're sold on this idea that their life is ultimately going to be dictated by how strict they can be,
yeah.
And then it ultimately becomes a bad thing for them because, you know, there tends to be a need for balance of all things, and so what's interesting is you see people who they do great 90% of the time, and then all of a sudden that 10%, it's hardcore, and then there starts to develop all kinds of, you know, complexes and everything else that kind of revolve around that, so it's kind of the idea almost of the fact that it's like, you know, if you hate your health program, I can guarantee you're not healthy. And it's, you know, it's the fact that these guys are so upset by what they have to do to what they think, you know, they need to do in order to be good, it's actually detrimental. And so
yep.
I say all that because one of the really interesting things that you offered to us on your webinar, which is a great resource for people to get out there and check out some new information, and I think, you know, get a better understanding of how this concept kind of originated and just how practical the thinking is behind it, and then some good application for kind of moving forward. But in there, I'd love for you to talk about this because I love this study. I'd love for you to talk to us about the rat study. Because I really think it is a defining characteristic of what health really means, and the problem is I think so many of these programs kind of go against that. So I'd love for you to talk about that.
Yeah, I actually first heard this one from Dr. Cobb from ZHealth, and so the researchers are doing a rat study, and you know the cool thing about rat studies is they're really easy to control. I mean, I've done human subjects trials and, you know, went great. All the people I had were completely awesome and, you know, made the study entirely possible. But in general, you know, working with humans is much harder than working with rats. So you've got a cage on the left and a cage on the right. They put a rat in each one and they put a little exercise wheel in each one. And what the researchers wanted to know, which is actually a very good question, is if we overfeed the rats, will they sort of spontaneously exercise more? You know, will it sort of trigger some type of, you know, regulation in their body that they'll just start exercising more, don't really gain weight because they'll be burning off those calories. So in the cage with the wheel on the left, they said, all right, Mr. Rat, you can get on the wheel whenever you want, not restricted, the wheel is free to move, you can hop on, exercise as much as your heart desires, and they keep track of, you know, how much the rat exercises. And the wheel on the right, I said, well, since we're comparing it, we really want to control how much exercise this little rat can do. So every day at 3 o'clock, we're going to turn the wheel on, I think it was like 45 minutes. So we're really going to control how much exercise the rat can do. There's a comparison. And so what they found in the study was kind of interesting, that the rat in the cage on the right, where the researcher turned it on in a fixed period of time every day, exercised for the first couple days, and after that just refused to exercise at all. The rat actually got fat and died early.
Wow.
And so initially the researchers are going, whoa, wait a minute, what the heck is this? And their theory is that, if you've worked with enough humans, it makes sense, that the rat in the cage basically lost all control over everything. He no longer could decide how much exercise he could do. The reality is you're a rat stuck in a cage, you don't have a lot of choices anyway. And the theory is that since he lost control of how much he could exercise and sort of gave up control in general, they just said, you know, F you, I'm going to show you. I'm just going to get fat and die early. I'm not going to do anything you tell me to do. And it's funny because there's always, you know, the few finds that are, you know, uber hardcore and will, you know, do whatever you want. It's like, hey, Johnny, go run through that brick wall. Yep, right away, chief, you know, away they go. But, you know, most people, it's amazing that the more strict and the more you say, okay, it has to be done exactly this way, the more they'll, amazingly enough, pay you a large sum of money and show up and really not do anything you told them to do.
Oh, yeah.
And anyone who's worked with clients will go, yeah, that's totally true. You know, and so I actually sit down and tell clients this little story, you know, and I'm like, here's the deal. The more you actually do, the more I will then give you to do, you know. And so for some people who's never exercised, it may be do one push-up on Monday in your home. Like, one push-up? Like, yep. Well, I want to do more. Well, you do that, and then, we'll, you know, tomorrow you do two then. You know, and they look at you like you're just a two-headed space alien. They go, well, what? This doesn't make any sense. You know, the reality is, one, I want to start at zero because I don't know what their tolerance is. I have no idea. If I start somewhere in the middle, I either have to go up or down. If I start at the bottom, I know I only have to go up.
Yeah.
And then it's just basically getting their confidence that you're still allowing them some control, and the more they do, the more they're in essence sort of rewarded with more to do. Instead of giving them this huge complicated plan and going, all right, you're eating chicken and broccoli the rest of your life, and that's the way it's going to be, and we're starting Monday, and it's going to suck, but you pay me, and that's what happens. And I just completely freak out and don't do anything.
Sure. Yeah, no. I love that, and that's the really interesting thing. We'll get into this. I think at some point we start talking about the applications of how to make ourselves more metabolically flexible, as you put it. But one of the things that I love is the whole George Costanza idea.
Yeah.
And everybody can hold off. We'll talk more about Seinfeld in a minute. But you know, it's actually such a brilliant idea, because you know the scientific model shows that results are first and beliefs are second. And so you know, we have this. Unfortunately, we're trying to spin this belief that, well, no, you got to get your clients doing all this stuff and going as crazy as possible. And, well, the problem is, it's not working. I mean, take a look around. And
yeah.
It's
people.
Absolutely. Well, cool. So I guess, so we have this idea now of metabolic flexibility that we want to be able to, you know, kind of, I think one of the things you're kind of pushing us towards is being able to move in and out of utilization of carbohydrates and utilization of fats as an energy source. Can you go more in depth on the crossover effect? I think this is probably a big key point that helps people to understand the idea of metabolic flexibility more.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this effect has been known about for quite a while. I can't remember if it was George Brooks that initially came up with it, but he's done a lot of research on it. And what it states is that as the intensity of exercise increases in a healthy person, your body will shift more from utilization of fat for fuel to utilization of more carbohydrates for fuel. And at some point, there's what they call a crossover, where you're now going from burning more fat to burning more carbohydrates. And this can be measured in the lab by the little fancy machines you see where you kind of breathe into this thing. It goes into a tube that goes into a machine called a metabolic heart. And on the newer ones, what it'll do is for each breath that you blow into the machine, in essence, it'll analyze it and say, all right, you're burning this percentage of fats and this percentage of carbohydrates. So when they do studies, they can then, it's an easy way to quantify what type of fuel you're using. And you can complicate the matter by, you know, feeding people different things, you know, maybe beforehand more fat or more carbohydrates. In general, under relatively lower exercise, the body will tend to burn whatever it's been fed. Now, that's not exactly true all the way across the board under every intensity. The literature is kind of mixed on that. But in general, if you had someone come into the lab and they've been doing a very low-carbohydrate diet, so mostly protein and a lot of fat, they will show that their body is then burning more fat. You've got someone who's more of your standard, you know, cardio bunny that eats mostly carbohydrates. They come into the lab, and they will, under the same conditions, so same intensity of exercise, they'll actually register that they're burning more carbohydrates. And that makes sense, right? Your body in general is going to burn what's available in a healthy person.
Sure. Very interesting. Now, so this is, you know, I think this is a very important point for the performance-minded out there, especially the endurance athletes. And I have several that I work with in this realm, from the, you know, the marathoners to even the iron guys. Talk to us about the idea that, you know, it's interesting you bring up the idea of the cardio bunny, and it's almost nonsense to me as to how we even came up with this idea of super high carbohydrate feeding when we know the way that the body would like to tend to utilize fuel, you know, in different endeavors. So can you go into a little bit further what might actually be potentially very beneficial for the endurance or performance-minded person?
Oh, sure. And I think a lot of the... If you look back in the literature, for example, it literally took years and years of multiple studies and a consensus in the literature to show that under long-duration exercise, if you take in some form of carbohydrate, you know, sports drink or something like that, you will actually prolong your ability to exercise. It's been shown, you know, multiple times. The theory is that the amount of glucose your body has stored, which is a stored form, is called glycogen, stored in the muscles and stored in the liver. And that amount is actually limited, meaning that depending on your intensity and all that kind of stuff, I mean, the average person, you're looking at maybe two and a half, maybe three-ish hours of, you know, pretty good exercise intensity before all your carbohydrate stores are actually burned up. So the theory goes that, well, if that's assuming that you're not drinking anything, you're just drinking water. So they go, well, hey, if we ingest carbohydrates, then we can have another source of carbohydrates during exercise, and we can therefore prolong exercise. And that actually has been shown to be true. The downside is that if you work with a lot of endurance athletes, if you take in a lot of carbohydrates during exercise, there's not a lot of blood flow in general going to your gut. Your body will want to redirect blood flow out to the muscles because they're working.
Yeah.
And this is actually based on a concept from Bob Sieberhaar, who calls it metabolic, I think, efficiency. And his point is that at some point, you take in enough carbs that are not perfectly timed, you'll get visited by what he calls the GI distress monster. And you're not going to feel very good. You're going to get nausea and all sorts of other stuff. And it was funny when I actually saw him speak in Florida this past June. I'm sitting there looking at his presentation. I'm going, holy crap, that's the same thing I do, just a slightly different name. So what he does is, if we look at it and we go, okay, well, the body has almost an unlimited amount of fat stores. Even in a relatively lean person, you've got tons of energy that can be derived from fat. So if we can shift the body to using more fat for energy, we don't really need that much carbohydrates to, you know, come in via beverages or that type of thing. Therefore, we also decrease the chance of being visited by the GI distress monster.
Yeah.
So oddly enough, he did the same thing that I was doing, which is kind of crazy to see, that he took guys and women and basically pulled carbohydrates out of their diet, which to, you know, a person who does a lot of cardio or aerobic training is like, oh my gosh, you're a crazy man. And just increase their fats, increase their protein a bit, and he actually at the same time decreased their training intensity. So he had them do, you know, a little bit longer runs but at a lower intensity. So in essence, what he's doing, which I agree with, is teaching the body to burn more body fat. So I've taken out carbohydrates, not many carbohydrates around to be burned, there's more fat to be burned, and I've also reduced the intensity of exercise. So if you go back to the crossover effect, at lower intensities in general of exercise, we will burn more fat during that time. And what he found was that, you know, within a short period of time, actually, in some people, 3 to 4 weeks, their performance dramatically increased, and the amount of carbohydrates they needed to take in during exercise was much less, and they also lost more weight because they're literally burning more body fat than what they were before. So it's kind of sort of almost the opposite of what you would think. By teaching the body to burn fat as its primary fuel source, it actually becomes more efficient. And again, these are primarily for people that are doing very, you know, longer endurance events. So the longer the endurance event, you know, the more that if you can shift the burning fats will be more beneficial, but to lower intensity.
Sure. And so we're talking in the 2-3 hour or 3+ hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. So an interesting point that I'm hearing, I think, from this idea is when we look at one of the things that, you know, I wish we could even have a whole another conversation interview based on just exercise and how we utilize that to form metabolic flexibility and just improvement across the board, whether it's performance or aesthetics. But it seems to me as though, given this idea and understanding of metabolic flexibility, that these exercise sessions that almost have us working more so within our limits, that we're not so just, you know, maximal, just killer stuff, that it's not so much of the body composition changes aren't coming from necessarily the quantity of fat utilized in that exercise session, but actually the quality that we are giving to the body, that now it's able to, it's learning to be more flexible with its energy sources. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, and I mean, obviously the amount of exercise you do is always, you know, it's going to matter. It's always,
sure,
you know, quality and quantity. So we're not saying that, you know, you do one quality push-up and, woo boy, your spare tire goes
away.
You know, but in a perfect world, if you go to more strength training athletes, and I've always wondered this, and I've read, I don't know how many literatures on it. In a perfect world, you would actually want the body for all of its extraneous energy. So if we look at this building muscle, right? Building muscle, although it's been argued back and forth, is probably a pretty metabolically taxing event. It's going to take some energy. How much energy is, you know, pretty debatable. In a perfect world, we would want to pull that energy actually from fat source. So we could simultaneously increase muscle and decrease fat at the same time. Fortunately, the physiology is kind of messy and it doesn't work exactly that way. But I think to your point that if we can try to shift the body more in that direction, then I think it'll be beneficial. So that you may not need as many calories as what you think you do, if you can try to get the body to pull more body fat stores as its caloric need goes up. It's, you know, excluding drugs, it's pretty hard to do that exclusively, but I think if we can try to, you know, push it more in that direction, it would be beneficial.
Well, no, I think that's directly to my point, is I think what we're saying now is, you know, to add more lean tissue or to truly ramp up fat loss or performance, it's not so much that we got to go so much harder, we just have to do it better. And through doing it better, it becomes so much more effective that we almost don't know at this point how easy it could be to get ripped, is what it sounds like.
Yeah, and it's because if you, the example I always use is, you know, a guy that's going to the gym that's doing a max deadlift, right? So deadlift, good exercise, you know, burns a lot of calories, compound exercise, whole body movement, can use a fair amount of weight, so all those are good things. And you're doing a one rep max, and you're watching it, and, oh boy, it's just looking pretty horrible. His face is already crinkled up like a prune, and, you know, the weight's 2 inches off the floor, and you're ducking down behind him because you're afraid you're going to get hit by one of his discs that come flying out of his back to the other side of the gym. And he, you know, gets it to about mid-thigh, and you see him, you know, heave back and hitches it. Oh, but he makes it. Drops the weight. I can guarantee, hopefully, he's probably not going to do another rep.
Well,
you know,
we hope
that his quality was so bad that it actually limited his quantity. And, you know, an extreme example is if, you know, you can deadlift 400 and you only put 135 or even 225 on the bar, you probably do a fair amount of reps. So you can probably get in a fair amount of volume of work by doing that. And I think back to your point is that people too often go to the gym, you know, looking to find their limit, and when they find it, it pretty much impedes their ability to do any more quantity of exercise. So that quality and quantity are more highly related than I think we initially want to believe.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think it speaks to the original point that you talked about, is that we are adaptation machines. And so
yeah.
If there's no off switch to adaptation, if we're teaching ourselves that something is impossible, then it's impossible. And so, yeah, why would our body let us get better at something that just sucks so bad? So,
oh, yeah, and plus there's, you know, potential risk of injury and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you believe the body is made for survival, which I would agree with, and not necessarily performance, you at all costs want to make sure you survive. So if you're doing a heavy deadlift and you think you're going to injure your leg and that may impair your ability to get food, you know, not so much in the U.S., but in general, it's probably not going to let you do the lift. And if you try to override that, yeah, you may make it, but, man, the cost of doing that, I think, can be really high.
Yeah. No, totally, totally agree, and that's, you know, definitely what I think more of us are seeing every day, just with the application of all this great information. I think one thing that I'd like to go into just a little bit more, for any of the science dorks out there like us that like to talk about all kinds of technical stuff. I know we were talking about, you know, keeping it easy and getting easy bits of information, but I'm sure you can still do this in the context of the subject. But I wanted you to briefly talk about not only are we talking about the back and forth of fat and carbohydrates, but even maybe a greater kind of physiological idea or marker in talking about the shifts between the parasympathetic and sympathetic sides, you know, kind of autonomic tone, and talk to us about some of the neural implications with this as well.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I did a lot of Z-Health study, and I've always been interested in the nervous system, because that, in essence, is sort of the governing system of the body. And just from a perspective of both, you know, performance and that type of thing. And I had mentioned earlier that I've done a fair amount of research on heart rate variability. And what heart rate variability is, it's a way to measure your relationship between parasympathetic and the sympathetic system. And this is of the autonomic nervous system. So you can think of the parasympathetic as the rest and digest branch of the nervous system. So it's more like the brake on your car. And the sympathetic is the fight or flight system, and that's more like the accelerator on your car. So, for example, this is primarily thought of in terms of innervation of the heart, but it applies to, you know, all systems in the body. So if you were to take a heart out, and they've actually done these studies, if you go to visibleheart.com, sponsored by Medtronic, and so they've actually taken human hearts that were not suitable for transplants, this was done at the University of Minnesota here, and actually put them on sort of a permanent bypass and literally reanimated them, started them up again. And, you know, and this has been known for a while, that if you pull a heart out, in essence, without any innervation from the body, it'll actually beat on its own at a rate of about 100 beats a minute, roughly. So, in general, the body is always under, at rest, more parasympathetic, in essence, stimulation. And the parasympathetic stimulation is actually decreasing heart rate, which makes sense, right? Most people's resting heart rate is, you know, 50, 60, 70, somewhere around there, you know, definitely below 100. So when we exercise, the first thing that happens primarily is actually the withdrawal of parasympathetic stimulation. So it would be like if you're driving your car around and you've got some pressure on the brake and some pressure on the accelerator, and you to go faster, instead of jamming down the accelerator, you actually start to remove the brake first. Kind of makes more sense. So I talked about heart rate variability. That's actually one way to determine the ratio of parasympathetic to sympathetic. So if we go all the way back to the crossover effect, which we had talked about, as you start to exercise and as the intensity of exercise increases, now you're doing some sprints and you're running faster and faster, that's actually increasing sympathetic stimulation. And in the body, what happens then is that pushes the body more towards carbohydrate usage. So the fuel then should be matched to the exercise. So higher intensity exercise, because of sympathetic stimulation, a few other things, pushes the body to use carbohydrates. So the two main drivers are primarily from a nervous system standpoint, parasympathetic versus sympathetic. From more if you go into the hormonal system, there's a whole bunch of hormones, but the primary one is insulin. So the guy I work with here, Dr. George Vilt, he sort of refers to the nervous system control is kind of more like the wired control. So if you've got your laptop and you've got to plug it in, you don't have a wireless connection, that'd be more like the nervous system. And the hormonal system is more like your wireless communication. The hormones are normally excreted from, you know, a gland or somewhere in the body, travel around via the bloodstream to, you know, whatever their target is. So insulin, as it's primarily increased, will actually push the body more towards carbohydrate usage and more higher intensity exercise. The reverse is true. If you have very low levels of insulin, for example, an extreme would be fasting, so no food coming in at all, your insulin levels are going to be very low, and you'll primarily be burning more body fat at that point.
Wow. So it sounds like at this point, obviously we understand the correlation that comes with lean muscle gains and fat decreases in our body. We understand how, you know, all the different markers of health that are changed because of that, but now it sounds like we have a greater explanation as to the different directions as to why those are associated with greater health.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting to see really how profound the effects are of such a simple program, which I think now is a great time to, if you want, to give us some nuggets, to give us some ideas on, okay, what is this, so we understand, we agree with this concept, so, all right, Mike T., what do we do now?
Sure. I mean, the main one that primarily controls it, as we talked about before, is exercise. You could have a whole hour upon hour discussion just on the effects of exercise. But if we take, for example, our diabetic friends, and they go do a hard exercise session, that most of the time, what we'll see is if we measured their body's ability to use glucose after exercise, it's much better. There's actually, you know, some type 2 diabetics that after exercise have normal glucose metabolism. So we know that biomechanically, you're moving around exercising the muscle due to, you know, GLUT4 translocation and yak, 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 all this other stuff. It enhances the body's ability to use glucose. So if you don't exercise a lot, obviously exercise is probably the fastest way to normalize your body. I mean, if we could create a cure for all sorts of things, it would probably be exercise. Exercise works to normalize just tons of stuff in the body. So the key is, as you had talked about before, is more exercise within your limits. Most people, again, are going probably too intense, and again, like we talked about, their quality is suffering, therefore interfering with their quantity of exercise. When I talked about Bob Stevenar and that he had worked with a lot of endurance athletes, the interesting part is that he actually cut down on the intensity of exercise that they were doing. And when you talk about the nervous system, that's actually pushing the body to be more parasympathetic dominant. So these people were probably highly sympathetic dominant. I don't have any data to show that yet, but high carbohydrate usage, higher intensity exercise, probably going a little bit, you know, too extreme, right? And the sympathetic nervous system on the high end is, you know, fight or flight, you know, pretty, you know, run for your life. And that's designed to happen over very short periods of time. You know, we'll save the whole stress conversation for another day. But if you look in the wild, you know, I know Robert Sapolsky has done a lot of really cool research in that area. If you're a lion and you're looking to chase a zebra, and let's pretend we're the zebra, you see the lion and you're going to basically run like hell. And it's probably not going to be for real long. It's going to be pretty fast. And you'll either make it or you don't really have anything to worry about at that point. But you're not going to go out and probably run at a high intensity for really, really long periods of time. So anyway, exercise and, you know, that's the whole debate of what's better, high-intensity exercise, low-intensity. In general, if people aren't doing anything, I like having them do some weight training initially. One, because that's going to activate a fair amount of muscle mass. It's going to increase resting metabolic rate through lean body mass. And once they're doing that for, you know, about three to four sessions a week, if they want to add some more high-intensity stuff after that, that's fine. In general, it seems to be about 5 hours per week of exercise seems to be ideal. And if you even get someone to go from 3 hours to 5 hours, there seems to be a quite noticeable difference. That's probably because most people aren't really that active. You know, I unfortunately did a lot of work, come home. Even if you exercise a half hour a night, still not that much considering what you normally do. So that's one way.
Very cool. Well, I think one thing I want to add to this whole deal is, number one, all the listeners out there, this is great because I think with time constraints of most lectures that might give, unfortunately can't go into great detail as to how to exercise to be most effective. And so this is great information. I think this is, you know, this is the first time that I've heard you be able to go a little more in depth into how to exercise to really ramp up the effects. And so I think this is great. I would love if maybe if you've got some resources that we could plug in real quick here to help people start exercising better. I think one of the misconceptions that a lot of people have is going, oh, so, you know, they want me to, you know, do curls and pink 5-pound dumbbells. They want me to walk in the treadmill. No, that's what we're talking about. We're not saying don't go work hard. We're trying to get you to work better. So if there's some different resources that we can give to let people go a little bit further, because I agree with you, Mike, that I think exercise really is so profound in its influence over our metabolic capacities and flexibility, and I think this is such an important point for people to understand. So if there's some different areas where you could direct them to learn more about that, that'd be great.
Yeah, basically it's the shameless plug as it sounds. I'd probably plug my website, which is this extremehumanperformance.com. You can probably look up my YouTube channel if you just go to search for Mike T. Nelson. You can find it too. I know Craig's got a bunch of information on his website too. So
awesome. Well, cool. Okay, so we've got exercise as one of our potential applications or interventions to creating more metabolic flexibility. What other ideas do you have for us, Mike?
Yeah, the other one is that for most people, they're probably going to have to decrease the amount of carbohydrates they take in. If you want the body to burn more fat, especially initially, then one of the easiest ways is to have more fat coming in. Some people get really, you know, tied up in the effects of insulin and all that kind of stuff. In general, carbohydrates will secrete more insulin, and that's, you know, by design. Because remember that if you were to pick one hormone that's probably the fuel selector switch, it's insulin. So as insulin levels are high, your body is going to want to use and also store more carbohydrates. So fats and proteins in general have a lower insulin response. It's a little more complicated, and I won't go into that, but insulin's not as big of a deal as people make it out to be. The simplest thing is that if you want to burn more fat, having more fat coming in is going to be a good idea. And in order to keep your calories down, because no matter what anybody tells you, calories do actually matter. You know, thermodynamics is still actually true. You will have to probably decrease carbohydrates. Protein in general, you can set at about 1 gram per pound of body weight. That's actually on the higher end of the spectrum. You can probably, you know, get by with less of that, even if you're reducing your overall calories too. But it just makes for easy math then too. So that also would help.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. With the, I think that's such a great point, that people really sometimes just really struggle to hear, but if you want to use fat, you got to consume fat. So it's fun because, because thus far, I think you have, you've really started to free people. Again, it's like the rat study. It's like we're starting to let more and more rats go exercise when they will. You know, talking about the fact that, hey, yeah, you need to eat some more fats. You need to go, maybe not exercise like a total just freaking maniac. Hey, you need, you know, it's like all the stuff we want to, hey, yeah, you need to go have your cheat meals. Great. Yeah. You know, I think this is good news. Good news for all of us. Is there anything? Well, I think this is a great time to talk about. We referenced Sunfolk earlier, so I want to get into it because I really, really love, I think, number one, because I'm such a Seinfeld fan, but number two, I think the idea is so perfect, is to live like George Costanza. And so if you can explain that application, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm a big Seinfeld fan, too, and if people can recall the one episode where George starts doing everything the opposite of he's ever done in his life, and all of a sudden, like, everything starts working for him perfectly. So he's on this mission to do everything the opposite way that he thinks he should, and everything starts working great for him. So I always struggle with, because you get the, you know, the elevator question. You know, I want to lose fat, and what do I do? You know, you got like 30 seconds to answer him. You don't know any history. You don't know anything. So I always give him sort of the George Costanza to do the direct opposite of everything you've done now. You know, if you're unhappy with the results of where you're at currently, then what you're doing, you've already proven isn't working. So
absolutely.
The logical solution, if you were just a shot in the dark, is to do the direct opposite. You know, so if you're doing a lot of, you know, moderate intensity, you know, treadmill work, you're not strength training, your diet's mostly, you know, primarily carbohydrates, I would try the opposite. I would go lift some heavier stuff, and I would decrease my carbohydrates. And it seems like so intuitively, like, simple, but it works pretty well. I mean, if you just have a short period of time and you're not doing anything custom, and someone says, well, what do I do? And you got like 1 minute. And the reality is, long term, that's what you're probably going to do with most clients anyway. I mean, obviously, you can individualize it a little bit more, but, you know, if they're at where they're at and they're unhappy with it, then by what they've been doing hasn't been working, and they've already shown that. So.
Well, yeah, and the unfortunate part is we have too many people that just severely try and defend these ideologies that they've been taught from someone else. Not even, you know, I don't know why we take things so personally. And their body, their biology is clearly saying something so completely different. And so, yeah, it's I think that is such good information for people. I think it's such great wisdom because it's so true. That is, I think, moving us closer to the, you know, the idea of the scientific method. At the same time, you know, I think you've done an amazing job thus far as taking very complicated information and complicated systems that, you know, our body is by far the most complicated thing I think that exists, and it's a really cool thing to see how easy you've made it, and it's just true. You know, I don't know if you have any specific testimonials or specific stories that you'd like to share with us, just to give us some ideas as to what's happened.
Yeah, I'm actually working on a product on this, and depending on people are listening to this, the live seminar will hopefully be the end of this October 2010. It'll be recorded for a DVD that will be out shortly after that. So I'm in the process of basically trying to collect as much data as I can, because I'm a, you know, uber scientist guy, and I like numbers, and my background's engineering and all that kind of stuff. So we've got, I mean, one guy, via a BOD pod measurement, which is probably considered one of more of the gold standards for body fat measurements, right up there with underwater weighing. He's gotten his body fat down to below 9%, and he's getting close to deadlifting three times his body weight.
Wow.
And, I mean, he's not a competitive lifter per se. I mean, he, you know, works a normal job, 8 to 5. Another guy, Adam Glass, is, you know, obviously he does a lot of exercise. He's been exercising for a long time. He's a little bit more of a extremist. So one of the things, once people get closer to being more metabolically flexible, is we actually have them, you know, add sort of what would be considered distress eating. So in a perfect world, if someone calls you up and goes, hey, let's go out to dinner tomorrow night. Oh, we're going to the Chinese place. Oh, okay. You go, all right, great. You'd go out and you would enjoy your Chinese food and not really think anything about it. You know,
yeah.
Knowing that your body could, you know, handle it and process it. You're not going to feel like you're going to sleep for 12 hours afterwards or be nauseous or, you know, whatever. So one way to do that is just to test various items. So I know Adam for a while was testing, ramen noodles, I think. Because when you think about it, and, you know, Adam's talked a little bit about this too, if, you know, an extreme example is, let's say you're a special forces guy and you get, you know, deployed over in Korea somewhere at, like, you know, 24-hour notice. Do you really want to be the guy that's, you know, packing all your protein powders and all your specialized food and all this stuff? It's like, no, you want to just walk in and go, hey, what's that? Oh, it's good.
I just went on vacation in Florida, and so, you know, we've got farmers that we regularly deal with, and, you know, I get my most of my produce from some local farms. I get, you know, my dairy, my eggs, all this kind of stuff from these very trusted sources. But, you know, I went to Florida, and I'm in the middle of nowhere that has only the most basic grocery store you can find. So the quality of the food that I had at my disposal is pretty different than what I'm used to. And the whole thing is, because I've been utilizing, you know, this understanding in my life, I'm able to go into this and go out to eat, you know, on vacation or go to the grocery store and have all these foods and not have the negative side effects to the point in which I can't even enjoy my vacation because my body can't deal with a little bit of, you know, lower quality stuff for a while. So,
yeah,
you know, the freedom there is awesome, and I have personally experienced that. And I would say a few years prior to this, I would have argued this over and over and over because of certain scientific theory. But when it's all said and done, it's very accurate. So,
it's not that I'm saying whole food, unprocessed fruit is bad at all. That's actually very good. I'm not saying that you need to go out and, you know, eat ramen noodles for every day of your life. And, you know, but the point is that you should have the personal freedom to decide. Like you said, I went on vacation and I didn't worry about it for a week. Oh, it's fine. You know, and each person should have the freedom to decide, you know, where do they feel, you know, comfortable. you know, and if people say, hey, I like, you know, eating more organic, unprocessed foods most of the time, I have access to them when I'm at home, I think that's awesome. That's probably a better way to go. The caveat, as you just stated, is you would still probably want to do enough eating of, quote, other stuff or, quote, bad foods so that when you would encounter that, you wouldn't have an issue. And again, like my buddy Frankie said, it's the minimal effective amount. And that'll vary for people. You know, for some people, it's, you know, a couple meals a week. Other people want more freedom, so they'll eat whatever they want most of the time. You know, and I don't have any issue with that, again, as long as you're, you know, making your goals and that type of thing. It should be that each person gets to decide how much of that they want to do. And everyone will have their own little, you know, set point where they feel comfortable. So, like, for example, today I'm, you know, working on writing up a study. So I decided, well, I don't want to eat as much. So I figured, oh, it's a good day to do some testing. So I've been testing protein bars and, ironically, Monster Energy drinks. Where, you know, like even a year ago, I did a whole study on Monster Energy drink, and I had never drank one in my life. You know, so I'm not saying that I'm going to live on Monster the rest of my life, but if I have a can on occasion, I don't really worry about it. I don't have any ill effects from it. I don't feel like I'm going to die or feel like I'm going to go to sleep after the caffeine wears off or whatever, you know. So, it's,
well,
you know,
one of the things that I think, I was going to say, one of the things that you and I have talked about before, too, and this is kind of a side note, but, you know, there is the principle of use it or lose it with our physiology. And,
yeah.
And you know, at some point, if the way that I see it, and I always kind of put it to people, is, okay, well, number one is we have detoxification pathways for a reason, and so we need to use them a little bit. And number two is, if you're going to be so ideological in your stance that you're not going to consume this stuff, that, oh my gosh, I'm never going to take in anything that's not 100% free-range, grass-fed, you know, local, organic, biodynamic, you know, on and on with all the different markers they have for it, I say, okay, that's fine. If you don't want to do that, that's fine, but I hope you taught yourself how to not eat for a day or maybe several days, if not longer than that, because there are probably going to be times where you're going to have to do that. So what do you want to be able to do? Do you want to have to fast for a week, or do you just want to be able to have some fried rice and not worry about it?
Oh, yeah, and I mean, then the last quick point to wrap up is that I actually do have people do, you know, a 24-hour fast or 16-hour fast or whatever. There actually is a research study showing that basically people that were very metabolically inflexible, if they did a fast, it temporarily restored metabolic flexibility, meaning that they were still under fasting conditions able to use fat as a fuel, which is a good thing. So that, you know, is one of the other ways you can increase metabolic flexibility, especially, and I totally used to be this person that, oh my God, if I didn't eat every 2 to 3 hours, I was, you know, dizzy, lightheaded, and cranky, and you know, and so that's probably not the best way to be, because my body had adapted to me eating every 2 to 3 hours. You know, now I can do more variable meal spacing, I can do 24-hour fast, and, you know, be okay with it. And again, going back to sort of a survival mechanism, you know, there may be some places where you're stuck and you don't have access to food for 24 hours. You can go, oh, I did that before and it was all right.
No, it's perfect. I mean, like you said, especially the, you know, one, I think what's really interesting that we're finding from this is the fact that not only are we talking about the ability to increase lean muscle gains, the ability to decrease fat stores, but the fact that with all of this comes is, you know, we're making it easier to do all this stuff, and one of those ways is actually to stop, to get off the spinning wheel of this, you know, eat every 2 hours bodybuilder style of, you know, of living. And what we're saying is, number one is free yourself from that, and number two is when you do free yourself from that, you actually make it easier on your body to accomplish what you want to accomplish, and that's amazing. That's pretty cool. So I think for everybody this should be very freeing.
Yeah, and the last point is that, I mean, Lane Norton has shown that there's, you know, pretty good research to show that eating every 2 to 3 hours in terms of muscle anabolism may not be the best idea either, that you actually need, you know, go figure, variability, right? You need the high levels of amino acids and ironically low levels in order to trigger the muscle protein synthesis process too. So his recommendation, he's done a lot of work on leucine and branched chains and everything, is that by eating larger meals spread further apart, that the anabolic response is actually greater. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, look at that. That's a pretty cool thing. We're always in pursuit of what can I do to be more muscular and less fat. And what we're saying is, it's actually not only do we have a new approach to it, but it's easier than anything you've ever done before. So
yeah, it's just crazy.
Albert Einstein said, in life, make things as simple as possible, but not simpler. And
yeah, I love the quote.
I think metabolic flexibility is hitting that nail right on the head. So if there's anything else, Mike, that you want to leave us with, maybe just wrap this thing up. We've obviously learned quite a bit, and you know, wanting to remind people to go check out extremehumanperformance.com and check out the webinars where they can get this information. I actually had the opportunity to just get on the webinars recently, and so not only do you get to hear this stuff again, but you get to see it, and you get to own that material. So, Mike, if there's anything else that you want to leave us with, that'd be great.
No, that's cool. Thank you very much for your time and all the wonderful interview, Craig. And I guess the main point is that I think variability overall is a good thing. We used to think that, you know, variability was noise and all this data, and we tried to eliminate it. And now we find out that, holy crap, there's a lot of information in there. And again, like you had mentioned, your body is always adapting. And so you just have to think of, you know, what is it adapting to, and then what is sort of the best way. And, you know, ironically, from what we know now, what's being sort of sold as you have to be more hardcore and, you know, suffer and do this every 2 to 3 hours and do this, and it may not actually be the best way. And it's for, you know, each person to, you know, decide how far they, you know, want to take it. But it's nice to know that you have the freedom to do it. Because the first last thing is that a couple of years ago I went on a kiteboarding trip down in South Padre, Texas, and you know, I was out kiteboarding, you know, every day for like 6 days, and I basically lived on, you know, I had one good meal at night. During the day I lived on, you know, water, Pop Tarts and protein bars. You know, and I had a beer, and then I got done, you know, riding at the end of the day, another one with dinner. And I got home, and I, you know, in a week, I had lost, like, 2 or 3 pounds. I'm like, what the hell is with that? And, you know, now I'm like, well, my calories are probably less. I didn't have any problem eating the foods. I was, ironically, doing more of a distress eating without realizing it. And I was active all day. I was out moving around for, you know, 5 to 8 hours a day. And so it's kind of funny how you look back and, you know, most people would be like, well, that's just insane. And there's nothing magical about me. It's just something that any, you know, most people, once they get to that level, you know, can do. And, you know, it's kind of nice. You don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
Like you said, that, you know, reminds me of the Lewis Black quote. He's like, in America, he's like, we're so worried about our health that we're not healthy.
It's absolutely true. Absolutely. Well, cool. Well,
yeah, well, thank you very much, Craig. Where can people find out more about you?
You can check out what we are doing at www.themovementdallas.com.
And if anyone's listening that are in the Dallas area, I've been to Craig's studio, and I've hung out at his house and drank his organic milk and everything, so I'd highly recommend you check out his place there. It's really good stuff.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you for for getting us all this information. It was amazing. I can't wait for more people to be able to apply this. And I know that if they have any questions or any concerns, they can find you on the web and pick your brain all day.
No problem.
Mike is here to help. So everybody out there, let him help you. Thank you, Mike. We are excited about metabolic flexibility and looking forward to applying it and learning more about it. Thank you, Mike.
Cool. Thanks, Craig. Really appreciate it.